Today's episode is really special. We're going to be discussing this month's pick with Audrey and Emily from The Year of Agatha. But be prepared. Since this is a mystery novel, we are going to be dropping major spoilers. Namely, we're going to talk about whodunit. So, if you're ready, grab your Deerstalker cap, a magnifying glass, and let's go look for some clues in Agatha Christie's Crooked House. Hi, this is Maria Blackheart, and welcome to the Misfit Book Club, a podcast for readers, weirdos, blue stockings, normals, detectives, madmen, mystery lovers, screwballs, and every type of bookish person in between. This is episode 12, and I'm joined by my co-host, Pixie Burger.
I'm freaking freezing, Maria. It is so cold here.
Oh, how cold is it there?
It's like 9 degrees. And it's supposed to get colder. It's really cold. I decided I needed to check the mail today. So I ventured out and I dressed up like Dr. Zhivago, like fur hat, wool mittens, like 14 layers of clothes. And I haven't warmed up since. That was like 6 hours ago. So yeah, I'm in bed with an electric blanket on my body.
That sounds heavenly.
I'm sure some of our listeners are like, oh, these whiny baby Southerners, they're so pitiful, but feel sorry for us, please.
Listen, I will feel bad for you in the summertime when you're like, it's 80 degrees, I'm dying. And I will give you sympathy.
That's true. Okay,
so, and honestly, I'm a little punchy tonight because I am traumatized. I don't even know that I can talk about it.
You don't have to.
Just kidding. I'm totally going to tell you.
Okay.
So I used to do yoga really regularly, and then we finished our degrees. No more free yoga. Didn't have the money. Didn't want to join a yoga gym, club.
Right. Yeah.
Organization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I let it go. And then at the beginning of this year, I was like, you know, I got to get on top of my health. And my husband has yoga through work. Really likes his yoga instructor. And he was like, oh, she has a studio, and you should go. So I was like, okay, sure. So I went tonight and I walked in and there was only one spot left and it was right next to this guy, which, you know, guys can do yoga.
Sure.
That's fantastic. So I set down my mat and so we start doing yoga, and every time this guy changes positions, he farts.
Oh, no.
And not like a little, like it is very clearly a fart, and they all smelled like rotten eggs. And I was downwind for 50 minutes.
Yeah, did that, you know, kind of kill your zen or pull you out of your brain space?
100%.
Oh.
And then the worst part of it is at the end, I'm rolling up my mat, right? Trying not to make eye contact with him.
With a farter.
Yes. And he looks at me dead in the eye and he's like, I hope my feet didn't smell too bad. I don't think it was your feet that was smelling. But of course, me being me, I was just like, oh, no, it was fine. And I just like rolled up my mat and like ran out.
That's awful. I have also experienced similar things in yoga. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And I'm also sometimes that person. I'm not usually one to fart in yoga, but sometimes my feet smell. I've also been the person to fall asleep, I'm sure, and probably like snore herself awake during Savasana.
I was behind the stealth farter, and now I know why that was the only position open in the whole room.
Oh, yeah. You were probably the last one to know that this is the farter, because there's always a person or two like that at every yoga studio, right? The person who makes a lot of noise and ruins it for everybody else.
He would fart and then be like, ugh. It's like, I don't know who you're fooling.
Not distracting at all.
So I'm currently super traumatized. I don't know if I'll ever recover.
I'm sorry. Maybe one day, like, we'll get so good at yoga that we won't even notice those people. There's a really great Broad City skit about this where everything in this like free yoga night studio is like disgusting. It's good. I would check it out.
So that's my story. How have you been?
I don't know. I really don't have a lot of personal news to report. I did. Fire and Fury came out a few days early, which if you haven't heard, go look it up. It's the tell-all book by, is it Michael Wolff? Is that his name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael Wolff.
About the Trump White House, which I have not bought this book. I don't plan on reading it because I'm already on the daily regular traumatized by stuff that happens at the White House. So, like, I don't feel like I need more, I guess. But anyway, not even last week. A few days ago, Macmillan put out their numbers for this book, and it's insane how many copies they've sold. Supposedly, they have shipped 700,000 copies. The book is in its 11th printing, and overall, it has sold 1.4 million copies, which is a ridiculous amount of books. I'm kind of staggered by that number.
I have my own kind of tiny Fire and Fury story. So after the Trump White House said that they were going to sue for defamation, which if you are a public figure, you can't sue for defamation. So there's no way that lawsuit will stick. So it's a frivolous lawsuit anyway, but he's a moron. So he doesn't even know what the word frivolous means. Anyway, point is, I showed up at my local bookstore and I walked in and I was like, hey, I'm trying to get a copy of Fire and Fury. And they just sort of looked at me like, oh, you sweet summer child. Aww. And they're like, OK, well, we'll put you in line. Well, we have like 25 copies and you're going to be number 80.
Dang. I mean, I can't endorse the book either way. I've read obviously some excerpts of it, but I am just really jazzed whenever books sell that many copies. That's good.
I am of the opinion that whenever people are reading something, that's good because that is a gateway drug to more stuff.
Yes, yes. If you're reading widely, it's especially good because mm-hmm. you're challenging your own worldview. You're trying mm-hmm. to take in things that you might not have otherwise. If you're just reading Bill O'Reilly books, it's probably not going to really inform you much or change you as a person. But I don't know. Maybe it would.
Aren't those just coloring books?
Yes, they are.
Asshole, sorry. I told you I'm traumatized.
It's okay.
Good thing we have a little short episode today because we have something special in store for you guys. As promised, we have an interview coming up.
Yes, this was an exciting proposition. I asked my friend Emily and Audrey from The Year of Agatha to talk to us about Crooked House by Agatha Christie. In fact, they helped us pick Crooked House for our January book. In 2016, Emily and Audrey started this blog project where they decided to read every single Agatha Christie mystery novel, and they did. And so to me, they are the smartest, most fashionable, wittiest book bloggers that I know. So I was super excited when they agreed, and we recorded an interview with them a couple of days ago, and it was just so much fun.
It was. And so we are about to play it, but make sure that you stick around because after that's done, we are going to share your opinions about Crooked House and your suggestions for further reading.
That's right. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Audrey and Emily from The Year of Agatha. Enjoy.
Hey guys, Maria and Pixie here, and we are super excited to be chatting with Audrey.
Hey.
And Emily.
Hey, everybody.
From The Year of Agatha.
Thank you guys for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
We have been talking you up for a couple weeks now, so our listeners are really excited, and so are we, to talk to the experts of Agatha Christie, all things Queen of Mystery. So Emily and Audrey have a fantastic blog called The Year of Agatha. They have really an incredible following of Agatha Christie fans and other bookish people. So would you guys mind talking to us a little bit about your blog, The Year of Agatha?
Yes, absolutely. So Emily and I have been friends for many years now. And during that time, we always found ourselves bonding over reading and British television, and in particular, the masterpiece mystery Agatha Christie adaptations. And so a couple of years ago, we decided we wanted to kind of give ourselves a reading challenge. And I had read most of the Agatha Christie books when I was a kid. And Emily had read some of the books as a kid, but not all of them. And so we decided to give ourselves the challenge of reading all of Agatha Christie's books in 1 year. We knew that we needed some way to keep ourselves accountable, so we decided to start a blog so we could catalog all our thoughts and feelings. And yeah, so we just did it. We kind of threw it out there on the internet to see what happens. And then almost just kind of like as an afterthought, we were like, well, I guess we can probably start like an Instagram or whatever. And we just found this really awesome community, particularly on Instagram, of people who are just obsessed with Agatha Christie, just like we are. So we ended up reading all of her books. We each read a book a week, But it was great. It was so rewarding. It was super fun.
That's amazing. So you guys have been friends for a while then, right? Did you go to school together or?
Oh, you go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, we have been friends, I guess, since 2011. We met through work. I was a managing editor and Audrey worked as a publisher. Unbeknownst to both of us, I think we were both looking for master's programs in communications at the same time. And Audrey's boss sent out an email to the whole company to be like, everybody say congratulations to Audrey on getting into the Johns Hopkins University master's in communications program. And I was like, hey, that's the one I'm looking at. So we ended up talking a whole lot and found that we had even more in common. From books to the West Wing to all kinds of other things, and eventually realized that we essentially have the same brain. So yeah, we've been friends for a while. Feels like longer than it's actually been.
Yeah, Year of Agatha is a big project. I mean, mm-hmm. 2016 must have been crazy, right? Reading all of those books together. And what was it like running a website with one of your best friends and having so much work to do on this huge project together?
It's been super fun, and I will say that I definitely feel like I could not have done it by myself. Audrey is a very good, she's probably more organized than I am, so she does a good job of, like, building our reading schedules and giving me assignments. It's been really fun and, like, a fun aspect of our friendship, but it's also been really essential, I think, to the success of the project.
Yeah, and I would say it was fun to have someone just to kind of throw ideas around with and to kind of have these like almost inside jokes with, if that makes sense.
Oh, that totally makes total sense.
Yeah. So one of the best things about our podcast is the people that we've met. We've kind of found this weird little misfit community of readers that we hoped would find us, and they did. Tell us a little bit about your readers and the people who interact with you on your Instagram. What surprised you about Agatha Christie fans?
I think one of the things that surprised us the most in doing this project is how many people there are who are into and really into Agatha Christie. You know, we wanted to read the books and enjoy them ourselves, but one of the reasons that we started putting it online and putting it on social media was that we wanted to try to encourage other people, especially people kind of around our age group, to get into Agatha Christie and sort of explore her work because we feel like it's pretty timeless. And so I think that's one of the really rewarding things and also things that especially initially kind of caught us off guard, just how many people, you know, love seeing her books on Instagram, love talking about them. I think that it was surprising how many people were willing to engage, even though that's what we were hoping for. So the community around her work has just, like Audrey said, been really cool to discover.
The only thing I would add to that is this past summer, we had the opportunity to speak at the International Agatha Christie Conference, which was at Cambridge University, wow, which was so cool. It was literally so much fun.
Yeah.
But it was really cool to meet people who had loved Agatha Christie for a long time. And just interesting to see how everyone's stories were almost the same, where it was like, how old were you when you started reading Agatha Christie? Oh, I was 10. I was 10 too. And it, you know what I mean? It was like very similar stories, just kind of these variations on a theme of kind of falling in love with her as a child. But at the same time, then also Instagram has given us this opportunity to meet people who are getting into her just for the first time, you know, having this movie Murder on the Orient Express coming out in theaters this past fall has kind of created this resurgence of people who are interested in her. It's interesting seeing people being like, oh, I've heard of one or two of her books. Oh my goodness, there's like 80 of them. This is great. So just kind of that varying level of interest it's just really cool to see.
So what was the highlight or maybe one of the unexpected highlights of reading through Agatha Christie back to back like that?
One of the things that I know that we remarked about during that year is we both kind of went into the year having a partiality towards Poirot as a detective. We are huge fans of the David Suchet TV adaptations. And so I think both of us kind of went into the project thinking we were going to love the Poirot books the most. And it was very interesting for us to find as we read them, we preferred to read the Miss Marple books. And so it was just kind of this like, yeah, it was a weird shift where every time we read a Miss Marple book, we were like, okay, I really loved that one. I really liked it. It was super great. So I think that was one of the surprising things. I don't know about you, Emily.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I was surprised that I loved Miss Marple as much as I did. I mean, we both love the Marple portrayals on TV as well, but the Miss Marple stories are just so fun. They're often very funny. Agatha, as a writer, is so talented because she does an amazing job of each of her detectives has their own kind of tone that goes throughout the books. I think it was also interesting that, you know, I end up finding that a lot of my favorites were the standalone books, which some of them are lesser known, like The Man in the Brown Suit or The Secret of Chimneys. So it was cool to discover some of her early stuff and find that it was really enjoyable.
Another thing that I think was kind of surprising, or just maybe more interesting, was for the most part, we read her works chronologically. And it was interesting to kind of see her go through her first books and, you know, really hit her like golden years of after World War II, where she's writing these great books every single time. And it was interesting by the end of the year, we're getting to the ones that she wrote right before she died, and they're really not terrific. But at the same time, it was interesting to kind of go through that full life cycle of the Agatha writing career and just kind of see it, how she progressed. That was very interesting.
Yeah, very.
Did you guys read her romances too?
The Westmacott's. Yeah, I've read one of them. We didn't include them in our project for the full year, but I have read one of them, and it's very different, but it's not bad. I would say it's not great. It's not terrible.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing I was going to say is that, especially in her early books, she almost writes them like romance mysteries. A lot of the relationships between the male and female leads feel like Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart or something. Mm. They banter and they bicker back and forth. And then somehow in the end, they fall in love, even though they've known each other for like a week. And I think she really enjoyed writing that dynamic. And even with like Hastings, part of what makes Hastings funny and a good foil for Poirot is that he is constantly falling in love with people like at first sight, even before he's like spoken to somebody. He's like, Poirot, that girl with the auburn hair. Poirot's like, please get yourself together. So I think she really just had fun with that. Those are some of the fun aspects of a lot of her books, even the murder mysteries.
So you guys know Agatha Christie, obviously, more than most people. What are some things that you learned about her that you feel like our listeners just need to know?
I think one of the most interesting things about her is something that you see inside of the front cover of a lot of her books, but that a lot of people don't know. She was the best-selling author of all time besides Shakespeare and the Bible. And she was like this little old British lady who decided she was going to start writing mystery stories because she needed some money. And in her autobiography, she talks a lot about her childhood, and she and her sister would make up scary stories to tell each other. And she would take these stories and kind of like tell them to her toys and stuff. And then eventually, as she became an adult, she was like, I think I'll try writing some of this down, just see if anybody wants to buy it. So she started out kind of serializing some of her stuff in magazines and things like that. But eventually, you know, she became, obviously, a very successful published author.
Yeah, and I was going to say, one of the things that I also appreciate about her, and I think is a fun fact, is she went ahead and wrote about stuff that she knew. You know, she was a poisons expert because she worked in a dispensary during World War I. So she chose poisons as the means of murder for most of her murders, as opposed to being like, oh, I'm going to read up on blood splatter, I guess. Like, no, she was like, I know about poisons and I can talk about a whole bunch of different ones and I can describe them. So I'm going to use that as my area of expertise and not pretend to know something I don't. There was, I think it's the Pale Horse, the particular poison that is used in that novel. She did such a good job of describing it that more than one, I think it was at least two people, like, wrote her letters and were like, I'm a nurse. I was able to diagnose somebody in that they're being poisoned with this particular poison based on your description in this novel. Wow. This particular poison. Yeah, that's something that I think is an interesting fact about her. She stuck with what she knew, and I like that about her.
I also think it's cool that as a child, or not as a child, I guess as a teenager, she got to travel a bit with her family. And then after she and her husband, her first husband, separated, hashtag Archie sucks, She
Amen, sister.
We have very strong feelings about Archie. After they separated, she and her daughter traveled a bit, and I think it's really neat how she incorporated a lot of her travels and her experiences in other places into her books. I think it's really nice that she incorporated so much of that into her books.
Yeah,
for sure.
So can we go ahead and talk about Crooked House?
Sure. Yes.
Very excited about this. I watched the movie last night.
Oh my God, it's so good.
So I'm also prepared for movie discussion.
Oof, can't wait.
We're prepared for that too.
I loved it. And my husband was like, had his hands in front of his face multiple times. Like, who is it? I don't know. He was like very invested.
Yeah. Audrey said her mom like screamed at the end. She was like, yes. What?
Yes. She did not expect it. My husband guessed it like right away. And I was really Nathan. Annoyed because I feel like it's such a surprising ending. He was like, but it was that little girl. And I was like, oh.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, spoiler alert.
They know. They know at this point we're going to ruin it. So.
We hate to ruin the ending of Crooked House because we both feel that this book is super brilliant. And we've always read that it's one of Agatha's favorites of her own work, if not her very favorite. And it was one that she spent years thinking about before she actually started writing it. I think it's evident just how intricate her mind was in the way that she plotted this book out and how surprising the ending is. I just think this is one of her best books, and it's not as well known as other ones. And it's definitely one that we like to recommend to people because it's just so clever.
So now that you guys have read all of them, do you feel like you got better at figuring out who done it in the end, or was it always a challenge?
Decidedly not for me. I think I figured out who it was like once. Audrey's probably better at it than I am.
Yeah, I was trying to think back. So since I read a lot of these as a kid and then like reinforced my knowledge of the plots by watching like all of the movies of it over and over and over, I was trying to remember if I had guessed who done it for a lot of them. But with Crooked House in particular, I can remember reading that like every few years, even up through college, and never remembering how Crooked House ended. I would always be like in the middle of Crooked House and say, who did it? I cannot figure it out. And I've read this book like 8 times. So I feel like that's another one of the brilliant things about Crooked House is that for me, I still wasn't able to get it, even though I had read it before. But when I was reading Crooked House for our discussion this time around, I like specifically looked for like the clues along the way for the killer. And they're there. They're all there. Mm-hmm. I wrote them down, but I just didn't see them.
Did you figure it out, Maria?
Yes, I did. Probably from like the first moment Josephine was introduced as a gargoyle or like a goblin child. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay. I was like, I've got my eye on you. Mm-hmm. And then right about the time she and Charles had that kind of second interaction with each other. And she's like, maybe I lie to you. Maybe I don't. I was like, you little sociopath, you're sick. But it didn't make it any less shocking for me because there's something about a kid. Mm-hmm. And this was one of the things I wanted to talk about with Crooked House. There's something particularly horrible to me about a little kid that reads murder mysteries. Right. And she's like, oh, this will add some adventure to my life, and like knocks off her grandfather.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the Crooked House is like the only one that had never been adapted as a film or television show before.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why. I feel like people were like, it is too creepy to put a murderous child on television. And I mean, the end of this one is like really startling.
Yes.
I feel like they could have added in some of the details from the end of the book to make it a little less abrupt and terrifying. I don't know for sure that that's why it's never been adapted, but that would be my guess. I think people were just like, I don't know if everybody's ready for this.
So are there any other Christie novels where there's a child who committed the murder that you can remember?
I don't think so. Hmm. Audrey?
No, there's, especially in her later books, Agatha got like very into being like, youths. Youths are killing people for sex crimes. Like
all the time. It was constant. She's like, they never wash their hair. They're always wearing baggy clothes and they're obsessed with sex and drugs. And she hated them. She, like, the beatnik movement was like super troubling to her. And she felt like her books should definitely highlight that they were ruining society.
Yeah. So I think there
there's also a couple other ones, like Evil Under the Sun is one that I can think of where a child seems like slightly suspicious. But I, even in that case, I think the kid is like a teenager, which seems like in a different realm of creepiness. You know what I mean? I think it's like a 15-year-old or something like that. And I think part of the brilliance in Crooked House is also giving her such a childlike motive.
Yeah.
Yes.
I wanted to take ballet and he wouldn't let me.
And it's like the motive that never gets refuted while everyone else's motives are like, yeah, no, they're not actually in love. I don't think, oh no, all these people have money. It's like, well, yeah, I don't think he ever did let her take ballet lessons. So I guess that must be it. So.
And that's what I found maybe really sort of horrible about it in the best way is when you're reading her diary entries and she's misspelled it as B-A-L-L-Y, like ballet, because that would be phonetic, right? If you spoke with an English accent. But at that point, you know, she's really young.
She's creepy. She's legitimately creepy. And if you watch the film version, you definitely get that impression.
So I suspected Josephine very much. I wouldn't say I figured it out early, but the scene where I was really pinged on Josephine was the conversation between Charles and his father, where his father had just said, listen, murderers want to talk because they're lonely and they don't have anyone to talk to about what they've done because they have to keep it a secret. And that really pinged Josephine for me because in the scene before she had just been running her mouth and telling everything that she supposedly knew to Charles. And so I was like, ooh, this is something. And then there was the other line about the two branches of the family coming together and how the ruthlessness of both families could have resulted in one just like horrible offspring.
Yeah.
Which of course could have been Sophia or Eustace. Is that his name? Eustace?
Yeah.
Or little Josephine. So a couple of things I was like really, really on with Josephine. And then sure enough, she's just a little tiny psycho.
Yeah.
But then what's interesting is, so even though you guys had kind of had your suspicions around her, did you see the ending happening with Edith de Havilland doing what she did?
No.
0%.
So I feel like that's another interesting, like, additional twist of, like, what? It was the kid. What? She's going to drive into a quarry? What?
Yes. Totally shocking.
Yeah. Just in case you figured out who the killer was, Agatha still wanted to add another little twist in there.
Yeah.
She's the best at twists. She's basically Chubby Checker.
Oh, man. Deep cut. All of our listeners are, like, 12 or something. They're going to be like, what? Okay, so talking about Josephine, I kind of also want to bring up, is Josephine bad because of the family she's born into, or is she just born bad? So this kind of like nature versus nurture discussion, because on some level, like, the Leonides family is jacked up, you know, so at the end it sort of waffles. On one level, it's like, well, Josephine was born this way. She just got the bad of everybody. But then Charles and Sophia are like, but it's so pathetic. Like, you know, her mom didn't really pay attention to her and called her this little changeling. Mm-hmm. So I think Agatha's also trying to ask us to think about, like, are you born this way or are you made this way? So what do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a question she asks in a lot of the books, at least in the subtext. Like, where did this come from? Why would this person have become this way? She's definitely, personally, I think, was more interested in kind of the psychology of how the victim came to be the victim and the psychology of how the killer came to be the killer, rather than just like the whodunit for her, I think, is secondary. But I mean, for Josephine, I don't know. Audrey, do you remember we listened to like a podcast or something about like psycho children, and it was about like parents being like, I don't know what to do, 'cause like, this is my kid, but like, she keeps coming in my room at night with knives. Like, what am I supposed to do about it?
I don't think so. That does not ring any bells.
Oh, okay. Maybe it wasn't you then. I listened to a podcast in which there were all these parents in the present day talking about just children who have got some issues. I mean, I think it could be a combination of factors. I am not a psychologist. I would just like to make that disclaimer.
I would say this. She does in several of her, many of her books, has a discussion about evil and whether people inherently will have it no matter what they choose to do. But this is one, she doesn't typically have this much discussion, I think, about the nurture aspect of it. And I think she was maybe using this as an opportunity to think about that by making this like the most dysfunctional family that you could ever imagine. And I feel like there's a bit of both in this one. I think Josephine was a little bit in trouble from the beginning, and then they didn't do her any favors.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of these people who end up being murderers have bad childhoods. You know, we're still asking that question today. Like, yeah. Are people just born evil, or are they made evil by circumstance? And I think on some level, like, if they're made evil by circumstance, we feel like maybe we could fix the problem. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a really kind of existential question too, right? What do we do with those people if they are born evil? Well, in Crooked House, we drive them into a quarry. Uh-oh.
Right. I think it's interesting at the end where they're like, oh, good thing she drove her into the quarry. Otherwise, she would have lived in an institution. And she's like, well, maybe that we should have let her choose. I don't know. But
yeah, I feel like a lot of times Agatha also doesn't know how to answer that question. Like, she definitely likes to explore it, but the means of justice at the end of a lot of her books is not like, oh, and you get the death penalty via a trial of your peers and a judge. It's like, oh, they killed themselves, or oh, they like accidentally died of something, or like they got caught by this person and this person killed them. Like, she doesn't like the traditional means of justice necessarily. And I feel like a lot of times, you know, maybe that's because she wasn't sure what to do with it.
That's not the sexy part either. Like, yeah. Going to trial and sitting in a jail cell and all that stuff is not nearly exciting. Yeah. Well, and the alternative is also unsettling. If people are made to be murderers, or if they grow into it as opposed to being genetically that way, or as opposed to being born that way, that means we're all capable of murder.
Yeah.
Right? And that is also a very disturbing thought.
Yeah, I think, I mean, and then there were none. I'm not going to release any spoilers about that one, since your readers, hopefully, if they haven't read it, they'll go pick it up, because that is another really excellent exhibit of Agatha's work. But that book really explores the possibility that it could be any one of us. And so I definitely think that's a concept that she considered as well.
Mm-hmm. So kind of going back to the Leonides family, one of my questions was, which member of the Leonides family do you identify with most? Because it strikes me that they all sort of represent a dark part of the human psyche, whether it's like too much love, too much drama, too much greed, too much anger, right? The seven deadly sins. So I was wondering, if you were part of the Leonides family, like, which one of them would you have been?
I think I would hope to be Sophia, because she seems the most normal.
She gets all the money.
And she gets all the money. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. She seems the most normal and just kind of bewildered by all these crazy people that she's related to.
Yeah, I don't like that question, Maria, because I don't want to be anyone.
I know. I mean, Roger with his, like, I think we can all be kind of insecure, and we find ourselves either at work or in our lives like, wait a minute, like, how did I get here? Is this like what I'm supposed to be doing with myself? And so I feel like Roger struggles with that a lot. I sometimes struggle with those things. So maybe Roger.
Fair enough. Like, I kind of get Clemency, right? She loves this, her husband. They're stuck in a place where she really can't be happy and her husband isn't happy. And they're asking Roger to be something he's not. And really, she just kind of wants to be poor and happy, not rich and miserable. Mm. Like, I hear that.
I have too many books and too much crap at my house to be Clemency. I don't think I could.
I was going to say, I want to be Philip, because he sounds like he just spent all his money on books. And he's just like, I'm just going to read over here. You can run the business. He's just like, well, Magda, I guess I'll throw you a play and a child every once in a while, I guess. But I'm just going to read.
No one wants to be Brenda.
Oh, poorest Brenda.
Brenda, a.k.a. Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
No kidding. Was she American in the novel? I didn't think so.
I don't think so. I think they've made her American for the movie, because he met her in like a tea shop, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she thought she was knocked up.
Right. And how they kind of throw out this little, like, is she smarter than she actually lets on?
Yeah. Was that a strategy?
So Brenda is in real life one of the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Her name is Erica Jane, and she was a waitress, and she met her husband, who's like a millionaire lawyer. And he's 40 years older than her?
Whoa!
Wow. Gracious.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's quite a topic for conversation on the show. Because everyone's like, do they have sex? What is their relationship really like? And she claims, you know, that they're very happy. But what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, so as soon as this person showed up in the book, I was like, that's Erica Jane.
Does every book have a reflection of the Real Housewives?
Usually, yes. Kind
of. They're universal characters. I guess that's why people love them so much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is interesting about Brenda, I think, is I kind of almost believe her. I believe that she legit was like, I'm tired of being a waitress. I'm just going to marry this, like, charming little guy. And I'll just hang out with his weird family. And I'll get money. And he'll buy me a boyfriend.
Yeah.
I feel like I kind of did believe her. And that's one of the things that's interesting reading through it is how much they just want it to be her. And it's like, I feel like you feel as the reader the same way Charles does, where you're like, oh, but I kind of believe her story that she.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You definitely end up feeling bad for Brenda.
Yeah, it's like Cricket House, the Anna Nicole Smith story.
Yeah.
It's like, that's basically what happens there, right? And she gets put on trial because they think she killed her, like, old husband for the money. But, like, she got off in the trial, didn't she? And then she ended up having some sort of, like, weird drug problem that ended up killing her. I don't remember.
I don't either.
I think that's right. Poor Anna Nicole Smith.
So what did you think of Charles as a detective?
Oh, Charles. Charles could be the man who saves the day in any number of Agatha Christie books. He's a little bit interchangeable with a lot of the fellas who turn up to be handsome and smart enough. I feel like in The Secret of Chimneys, which I did really like, and Why Didn't They Ask Evans? There's a guy, and he is, like, not a dummy. And so he can kind of work things out. And I wonder who it is in Agatha's mind that she keeps writing. Mm. It's definitely not Archie because that guy was not nice. She had a couple of, like, friends of her older brother that she loved as a child who could have been that person. I've wondered before, like, who is this she keeps writing? Who's this, like, nice, smart enough fella, pretty good looking, not, like, weirdly handsome or anything. She does often, I think, drop enough hints. She wants the reader to know this lady's really the brains behind everything. And I don't know. That's one of the things I really liked in reading so many of the books, is that it was sort of feminist of her to constantly make the lady the smart one. And the lady knows what to do and figures out what happens. And sometimes the guys are like, no, don't go in there. It's way too dangerous. And they're like, oh, please. And then they go in and, like, solve the crime by themselves and, like, end up defending themselves with the tiny knife they keep in their boot or something. So I think she really liked writing these, like, plucky heroine-type characters who are smarter than people want to give them credit for. And she gives them a man to be a nice foil. Or not even a foil, I guess that's the wrong literary term. But she gives them a man to be their sidekick.
And one of my favorite parts about Charles is how he gets so played by Josephine. And how she tells him constantly how stupid he is. Like, you idiot. How have you not figured this out yet?
Although, is it Charles's father who, it's kind of early on in the book, which I feel like is another clue, when Charles is kind of, like, checking in with Dad and, like, updating him on what's going on. He's like, hey, keep an eye on Josephine.
Yeah.
And it comes across a little bit like, I think that he even does explicitly say, I don't want anything to happen to her. But I think also mixed in that is, I don't want other things to happen to other people, maybe.
I think the last lines of the book can be read that way.
Yeah.
As though he had a suspicion about her from the beginning.
Right. And which all comes back to, like, do we feel bad for Josephine or not? I think I don't know. We didn't really talk about, do we feel bad for Josephine ending up in the quarry?
I do. She's evil, and she's done a lot of evil things, mainly for her own amusement, which is super creepy. But she's scared because she's a little kid still. So, like, even though she has these, like, evil things inside of her that are driving her to do grown-up bad stuff, I think she still also, on some level, has to be a child. And I don't know. I think that's why I kind of feel a little bit bad for her. And maybe poor child is the right sentiment, because it's like, oh gosh, there was a lot going on there. And that's just a sad story.
I was trying to think back to the interactions that she had with people that weren't Charles, people that were members of her family in the book. But I think the only, like, positive one was when Edith is like, hey, you want to go get an ice cream? And she's like, yay. So, I mean, yes, I think I do, in the same way Emily described, feel sorry for her for the mess she made for herself and the road she went down, it is nice to at least see that someone gave her a little bit of love on the way out, I guess. I feel like Nanny was maybe kind of nice to her, but she didn't let Nanny be nice to her.
She thought Nanny was dumb, so she was not interested in Nanny's niceness.
I don't know. I feel kind of bad to say I don't feel that bad for Josephine. She's a child. I know. And you're obligated to feel sorry for a child. And that's what everyone in the house is saying. Like, poor Josephine. Like, pathetic Josephine. It's so sad. But are they really sad? Or are they relieved? I mean.
Well, that's sort of the question at the end, right? Is they're like, well, maybe Aristide wanted to keep her at home because he knew she was dangerous. Maybe they wanted to send her to Switzerland to try and protect her or reform her in some way.
Maybe it was actually an institution they were going to send her to.
Or to protect themselves.
Yeah.
I just have this mental image of creepy Josephine, like, over your bed in the middle of the night. And, like, the lamp comes on and she's like, hi, do you want some hot cocoa? And you're like, ah!
Terrifying.
Yeah, mixed feelings. Mixed feelings about Josephine, for sure.
Yes, definitely.
I don't think we're bad people for side-eyeing Josephine real hard, like.
Well, yeah. I mean, she killed a bunch of people.
All I know is if I ever have a daughter and she's like, I need ballet lessons, I'm going to be like, okay.
You got it. Let's buy you a tutu. Yes, I think the underlying message of this book is encourage your children's dreams or they might kill you.
Support the arts. Love Agatha Christie.
Do you guys have any other thoughts or comments about Crooked House that we haven't covered yet?
One thing that I had just like thought of when I was reading reading it this time around. Have either of you read And Then There Were None?
No.
No, I haven't read that one, Audrey.
It's really great. I highly recommend it. It is considered her best, but in reading Crooked House again, so the premise of And Then There Were None is these people that are kind of like trapped on an island with a killer and they don't know which one of, people start dying and they don't know which of them is done.
It's the ultimate locked room mystery.
Yes, it's quite fantastic. And in a, almost in the same way, Crooked House felt that way a little bit too for me when I was reading it this time, because it is like this idea of being locked in this house and you as the reader feel... Like, I just kind of felt claustrophobic reading it because, like, so much of the book takes place in the house. And you can tell they, like, don't leave the house. And they're just, like, always with each other. And so just that kind of that idea of, like, we're here with the killer. Which one of us is it? It felt very reminiscent of And Then There Were None, but kind of, like, the next level.
Okay, so do we want to talk about the movie just a little bit?
Sure.
The movie and the book are not exactly the same. So you guys love the movie. Why do you guys like the movie?
I think we both, like, in watching it, it's so well done. And all of the, of course, all of the actors, many of whom you recognize immediately from other successful productions, are so professional and just really nail the characters. I know sometimes when you see an adaptation of a book, it can be frustrating to be like, ah, that's not how I pictured, you know, so-and-so. That's not how I pictured Poirot, Kenneth Branagh. Mm-hmm. But I think that they did such a good job with casting the people in this movie. And the production value is just incredible. It's super gorgeous. And the house, they do a good job of portraying what I think would be a very difficult set. You know, they did make some small changes, but for the most part, they're very true to this story, aside from just like a few smaller elements. And I think that really added value to the way they told the story. Audrey?
Yeah, I felt like all the things that they changed, I felt like I understood why they did. I mean, I feel like I do understand what they did with Charles and Sophia and the way they changed that a little bit. And it did definitely add a different level of tension there. And I did kind of like making Charles kind of more of the front man as opposed to being like the guy that was just kind of hanging out in all the meetings and waiting for people to ask him why he was there. And since this is the first time it had been adapted, this is a book that I've always just kind of like had these pictures in my head of the people. And I feel like for me, at least, they really just nailed that. And the tension was really well done. And a lot of it was just Agatha's straight dialogue. That dinner scene where they're all there.
Ooh, the dinner scene is so good.
So tense. I just loved it.
Now that felt Real Housewives to me.
Legit dysfunctional family behavior.
And the dialogue's so snappy. It's just like rapid fire. That was probably my favorite scene of the whole movie, I think.
Me too. I thought that was really well done. And it did such a good job of really highlighting, like, it could be any of these crazy people.
Including Sophia.
Yeah.
I was like, you are also kind of nuts and not very nice.
Yeah, she does come across a little more,
she's harder.
I was reminded that she is kind of a more lovable, fun-loving girl under strain in the book. Mm-hmm. Like, she's just kind of, you know, back home with her family, not living this kind of, like, fun life in Egypt. She kind of almost comes across a little snobby in the movie.
Mm-hmm. And more, like, manipulative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I did wonder, Sophia, as a suspect, how long did it kind of take you to look at her as a suspect? Or did you look at her as a suspect? Either in the book or the movie.
In the book, I feel like I looked at her very fleetingly, if at all, as a suspect. In the movie, I feel like they did a good job of making her seem a little more suspect, which made her a better potential suspect, I thought.
Because she definitely has motive.
Right. And I feel like it would have been very Agatha to also have made it be Sophia. Agatha does a good job in the book of also making you kind of like in that third act being like, wait a second, Sophia's getting all the money? Wait a minute.
Hold that phone.
Lucky Charles, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Getting married to, what, 100,000 pounds sterling?
Charles is like, now I really gotta solve this mystery.
I don't know if he doesn't get it or if he's just acting real cool about it. He's like, yeah. Oh, all right, well, let's get this figured out, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's not very British to care about money, so it's not like he could be like, oh, shit.
True. True.
It's true.
But I do feel like he got a little more energy after he heard Sophia is inheriting everything. He was like, I swear to God, it's one of you and we're going to get it, right? We're going to nail this to the wall. And of course, like, his confession of love is very sweet. It's like, I don't care about the money, Sophia. And I was like, all right, buddy. Like,
I'm looking at the date of this book to see if it was written before pre-Archie or post-Archie.
Oh, this is 49. It's definitely post. She had lots of money herself, Agatha did at this point, so.
And that was one of my favorite parts of just Agatha's own story, is that she's like, I slowed down writing because of the tax implications. Like, I was making way too much money. And you're like, what a problem to have.
Well, and she also was like very clear, like, you know what? I wanted some new curtains, so I wrote this book. It's not my favorite. You're like, okay.
I respect that, just so you know.
Yeah, I do too. I wish I could do that. Maybe someday.
Have you guys talked about writing a book?
We indeed are working on a book. Well, okay, so we were very ambitious when we first started The Year of Agatha, and we were like, we're going to run this blog, we're going to read all these books, and we're going to write a book this year, which didn't happen. And then last year, we were like, okay, now we're going to write the book. And we did a decent amount of brainstorming. We have some good storyboards, but did you guys know that it, like, is hard to write books and takes a while?
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. So it is something that we're working on, and we're hoping to do that this year. Right, Audrey?
Yes.
So that's our plan.
Now that you guys have finished all the Agatha books, what does your blog look like now?
We had spent so much time reading Agatha Christie that it was like we just needed a little palate cleanser. We love her books, obviously, but I was like, I just need to read something a little different, a little modern that will make me happy. So we read some different stuff and we did some blogging about it. So we're getting back to our roots this year, and we're revisiting some of our favorites. We're each going to revisit a favorite each month. We also became low-key super obsessed with vintage Agatha Christie books, mostly me. So one of the things we're also doing, like we did last year, is filling our Instagram with pictures of all of our fun vintage copies of her books.
And let me say, your Instagram is beautiful.
Thank you. That's a huge compliment. We try to have a style. You know, her books are, you know, obviously there are so many of them and there are so many editions of them. The same publisher has, you know, so many different editions of her books. And it's fun to see this, like, the wacky covers and, like, the ones that make sense. And then ones that you're like, this has nothing to do with this book at all.
we really want to try to figure out who these designers are that did this amazing graphic cover work. And it is basically impossible. If any of your listeners know a lot about cover art and how you figure out who did really cool designs in the 1960s for mass market paperback books, we would love to know, because there are some, like, especially these pocketbook editions that have just like a really graphic, almost like Pantone style block of color with like a cool small image on them, and then, you know, black and white kind of text, or some of the Fontana editions that are really fun in 60s. Like, we really love them, and we can't find any information about these graphic designers who built these really cool covers.
Make yourselves known. Come forward.
So why don't you guys tell our listeners where they can find you if they love Agatha and want to keep tabs on what you guys are doing?
Yes. So definitely follow us on social media. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. And our handle is The Year of Agatha. And then you can also find our blog. It is theyearofagatha.blogspot.com. And we have a great archive of our thoughts and feelings about all of the Agatha Christie books that we read. So if you're interested in if you are looking to pick up a book of Agatha Christie's for the first time, we have a quiz for you to take about that. It will direct you in a good direction. We have a quiz about which book you should read next. We have t-shirts. We have, reviews of all of her books.
Tote bags. We have tote bags.
Don't we have the tote bags. Yes. We have an email. It's theyearofagatha@gmail.com. If you ever just want to ask us a straight up question, we will try to answer it.
I've also heard that you guys are working on some other new projects and adventures, you enterprising young ladies. Do you want to talk about that at all?
We love Agatha Christie, and we are excited to continue talking about her books, but we also really love a lot of other books. In the past year, we've tried to integrate our love for other books kind of into our Year of Agatha platform, and we realize that can be kind of jarring for people who come to us for one thing. So we decided this year that we would like to take our style and format and then doing our own little review of the book into a format for new releases and books that are new to paperback. And so we're starting kind of a spinoff project called The Book and Cover. It just came out this week. We were really excited to launch that. And you can find it at thebookandcover.com, all spelled out as words. And then you can also find our new Instagram. That'll be at thebookandcover. That's also going to be on Twitter and Facebook. So we're really excited to read some brand new books by new authors and share our thoughts and feelings on them in much the same way as we have before. Our plan for the format of this is to write it in similar style and format as we did The Year of Agatha. And at the end of each post, we'll say that, you know, we think you might like this book if you liked these books before it, so that people can get kind of a clue about, oh, I really did love, you know, All the Light We Cannot See. So maybe I will like The Women in the Castle, which is the first book that I'll be reviewing for The Book and Cover this month. And Audrey read The Immortalists by Chloe Benjamin. So we are pumped.
I'm so excited.
Thank you.
I don't know how you do it all. That is a lot.
Well, you know, we both finished graduate school and then we're like, oh, too much free time. I hate free time.
I can't wait to check out that blog. That sounds fantastic.
Thank you. We're excited about it. I think it'll be super fun.
So one last thing before we let you go. We also recommend books for our listeners. So what would you recommend for people who loved Crooked House and might want to read a couple other books?
Ooh, this is a good question.
Oh, that's a hard one.
Since I was just reading The Immortalists by Chloe Benjamin, which, spoiler alert, I really enjoyed. It's interesting because I feel like Crooked House is like this family saga. So, but it kind of almost had a similar vibe where it's like, you know, kind of family members and their interactions with one another and kind of the choices they make. That's one.
A book that I read last year called A Reunion of Ghosts by Judith Clare Mitchell is a super great book that everyone should read because I really liked it. And it's about a family of sisters, and it delves kind of into their past and almost like the ghosts of their family that lead to the consequences that are being planned in the book in the present. And so it's about a family and the way that they're their past and their interactions kind of shape each other and the decisions that they make.
Awesome. Those are great recommendations.
Totally. We love getting recommendations and giving recommendations. So thank you guys. That was great. Thanks. You also just so much for being here today.
Ah, thank you. It was super fun.
What a fun conversation. I've been looking forward to this for so long, and it was just as fun as I expected.
Thanks for helping us evangelize about Agatha even more.
All right, guys. Thank you again so much. And once again, if you have any time, please go check out their website. Their websites now. Yeah. They're so fashionable and fun, and I promise you won't regret it. So thank you, Emily. Thank you, Audrey. We really appreciate you being here today.
Thanks, Pixie and Maria. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
And we're back. How fun was that?
I had the most fun. I kind of want to be them now. Is that weird?
No, they're so great. They are great in real life, too.
Yes, and they are so great on social media, so I hope you guys really do give them a follow.
Yes, and I'm super excited about their new project, the book and cover. Actually, they had kind of hinted to me that this was coming, but they wouldn't tell me what it was until we had our conversation. So I was super excited to hear about it, just as you guys were hearing about it.
Sneaky ladies.
I know. They're very enterprising, very busy.
Honestly, I feel so lazy.
I know.
Like, we do one podcast every 2 weeks, and I'm like, I'm really tired. This is very hard.
Well, speaking of being busy, you've had some really good questions on Instagram for our listeners to interact with this week.
Yes, I was inspired by our conversation with Audrey and Emily about the killer, and we had a lot of questions about Josephine and whether she is born evil or whether she was made evil by virtue of her family. So we kicked that question out to you guys, and you had some really, really good answers. So at C'est la vie dans les livres, which I just slaughtered, so sorry about that. She has kind of a long response, but it's really, really good. And she says, define evil. As a psychologist, not the type that gets you on the sofa, I believe that it is not a question of this or that. Some may be born with abnormalities in the brain, like an appropriate amygdala size, which may influence how they respond to their surroundings or their inputs. In this case, this is a case for nature. Others may be brought up in an environment with abuse or violent upbringing. This is nurture. Or it could be that the individual is born with some abnormalities and then is brought up in an environment that encourages such behavior, like ADHD and dysfunctional families. And so this is nature times nurture. And so she says that for Josephine, Josephine's clearly a product of her environment. So it's not that Josephine was born evil. It's that she kind of became that way.
I think Josephine might have been born evil, too, and then was encouraged by her terrible environment. I think it might have been nature and nurture for her.
All I could think of was like a child of the corn. I was like, Josephine.
Pretty scary. Nordic Souls book says this question probably has a bit of both in the answer. Someone may be perhaps genetically more vulnerable for aggression or other stuff, but it would take the environment to trigger it. So yeah, similar response, but yeah, very, very thoughtful answer.
And then at Literati says, ooh, this is such an interesting question. Read Truman Capote's In Cold Blood for thought-provoking look at this question, which I included that because I thought it was hysterical. Of course a bookworm would answer a question with a book recommendation. You are our people.
That's right. I love it. Then you asked the question about people's favorite fictional detective. And this was a wildly popular question, Maria. Good question for everybody.
People had very strong opinions about this, and so we had so many opinions about this that we thought we would give you your own recommendations rather than recommend books for you in our typical What to Read Next segment. Torrance at Torrance Watkins suggested Basil from the Great Mouse Detective, which that movie is criminally underrated.
We should also mention that Torrance is our friend from the Pseudophiles podcast. Mm-hmm. Bella at Look Bella Lacey and Finley at Finley are both all about Jessica Jones.
I think she's kind of great. Kay at AKA Kiss Kiss and at Lolo XXOO both love Eve Dallas from the J.D. Robb series. Actually, J.D. Robb is a pen name for Nora Roberts. And then she writes these great like techno thrillers set in the future based all around Eve Dallas. And I've read a couple of them and I really like them.
Yeah, I've heard they're really good. They're actually on my list to read. Jessica, and I'm going to butcher her handle. I'm sorry. At Bitter Dimphna, is that right, Jessica? Says Nancy Drew. And of course, boom, both Maria and I love that answer.
There were lots of Sherlock Holmes votes, including mine. He is my favorite fictional detective, and he was mentioned by M at Bell's Books and Lubna at The Literary Junkie. And Sherlock is fantastic.
Classic. And 799 Books mentioned my favorite, who is the beautiful and snappy and intelligent and ever resourceful Veronica Mars. I'm still getting over that show, by the way.
I haven't seen it. I'm ashamed.
It's fantastic. You would love it. Do you have any others you want to mention?
I do. There are two I want to mention. Sydney at Tell You No Lies. She's also from the Pseudophiles podcast. And she mentioned Nick Valentine, who is a video game character from Fallout 4. And he's this great, like, noir detective who happens to be a robot. And Joe at All Weather Reader loves Harry Dresden from the Dresden Files, who is a wizard and a detective.
Love it. You guys gave a bunch of really good answers, so thank you for interacting with us on that question. I feel like I have a lot of TV and movies and books to read.
Yeah, and there are so many more. So make sure to go to our Instagram page, click on the image with this question, you can't miss it, and read through all the responses because they are all so good. You guys love your mysteries, and we love you because you love mysteries.
That's right. So that's about it. That's about it for Agatha Christie, I guess. That means that we get to tell everyone what our next pick is.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about this.
Do you want to tell them, Maria?
I will. We are reading a romance novel in February, which is perfect for Valentine's Day. And we are reading The Rogue Not Taken by Sarah McLean. And it's book one in the Scandal and Scoundrel series.
I can't wait.
The cover is so good. It is a woman in a beautiful dress on a fainting couch. Yes.
What else do you need? If you open up the flap, there's also a handsome man with the beautiful woman in the beautiful dress. So, I mean, it's got everything. I am so excited about this one because Sarah McLean is everywhere. People love her books and she is doing really well.
She's one of my personal favorites. Her writing is really snappy. Her women are very clever. And the books tend to be very steamy. You're going to have to, like, unzip your jacket. It's that hot.
Whew.
And I can't wait to talk about it on this podcast.
I can't either. I can't wait to talk about romance. I feel like we've mentioned it a little bit here and there as a genre, but it's not gotten a deep dive like it deserves. So I'm really excited to talk about it in that way.
Romance is a $2 billion industry.
Exactly.
So people are reading it. And it's primarily written by women. It gets kind of a bad rap for being soppy, but a lot of the books are really feminist. You know, one of the things about romance is kind of a catch-all genre. So, you know, you have contemporary romances or sci-fi romances or fantasy romances or historical romances. And, you know, you pick kind of your favorite genre and then pick a romance book that intersects with that. I read historical romances like they are going out of style. I really love them. And if there's a pirate involved, arg.
Well, this one is definitely historical. So it should be exactly what you want it to be. I have a feeling it will be.
One day I'm going to write a steamy romance novel under a pen name, and it's going to be so great. But yeah, I mean, and there are a lot of smart women writing romance novels, and I'm ready to... Oh, I just threw things. I'm so excited. I am ready to share my passion and love with all of you. I mean, my passion and love for romance novels specifically, not the other kind of passion and love.
Might be crossing some boundaries there. We hope you guys will read along with us. Our first episode of February will be spoiler free, so you can tune in and listen to whatever we have to say about romance novels. Maria obviously has very strong feelings, and I do too, actually. So that will be the deal with episode one. Then the second episode, per usual, we'll talk a little bit more about this novel in particular, The Rogue Not Taken by Sarah McLean, which, by the way, she has the best titles. So we're excited for February, and we're so glad you guys have joined us for January as well. It's been a lot of fun.
And that brings us to the end. So Make sure you guys are talking to people about our podcast. If you're enjoying what you hear, tell somebody about us. We really want to spread the word so that we can grow our online community, which is so warm and welcoming and safe.
It absolutely is. So tell people about us, and then you can subscribe and review. We really appreciate reviews and ratings on iTunes. You can also find us on Google Play, Stitcher Radio, and TuneIn Radio. And then also, you can follow us on social media as well. Our Twitter is Misfit Book Club. Our Insta is also at Misfit Book Club. And Facebook is Misfit Book Club. Or you can email us if you want to at misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com.
Yes. And make sure to join us. You can find us on Goodreads. Just search for that email address and we will pop up. We're always looking for more friends on Goodreads. And, you know, make sure to join in the conversation. All of our followers are so nice. And I feel like they're becoming friends. And that makes me so happy.
Me too. I love it. Thank you guys so much. And we look forward to talking to you later.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.